Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The New Statesman.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
I'm Freddie.
I'm Will.
And this is the New Statesman's twice-weekly politics podcast. In this episode, we'll be discussing the rise of greedflation. Then you ask us about Labour's housing plans. We're really pleased to be joined today by our business editor, Will Dunn, who's been digging into the inflation figures to work out exactly why prices are actually so high. He's written the cover story in this week's magazine on the phenomenon of greedflation. So, Will, will you just explain to our listeners who might not have heard the term, what is greedflation?
The idea is that when we look at inflation, it's not a single thing that has happened. It's waves of inflation. So the first one was caused by everyone staying at home and buying loads of rubbish on Amazon. And that meant that the prices of what economists call durable goods went up because everyone wanted them. And then as economies opened up, there was a second wave of inflation caused primarily by the price of energy. So there was already rising price of energy due to a whole load of factors before Russia invaded Ukraine. And then Russia invaded Ukraine and caused a very sharp spike in the price of energy. So you had a demand-led inflation, then you had supply-led inflation, and now you have what a number of people think is profit-led inflation. After years of stories about why prices are going up, and indeed very good reasons for prices to go up, companies are adding a bit to, here and there to, as the Governor of England, the Bank of England has put it, rebuild their margins. It's not necessarily that companies are doing something really evil and just price gouging us for everything we've got, although possibly that's the case in the case of some companies. But it is more that across the economy, where it is possible to explain to the consumer this is why the price of something has to go up, it may be that they're also making up for some lost profit here and there. And that while the prices of food have been rising at a rate of over 19%. Wages aren't rising anything like that much. And that's why I thought it was very important that we drew attention to it as a cover feature. It is contentious that not all economists think that this is happening. The Bank of England has said that across the whole economy, profit margins are relatively stable. Now, what that tells me is that across the economy, the cost of the war in Ukraine is being passed on to the consumer, and it's being passed on most steeply to the consumers who can least afford it because, you know, the inflation, again, not just one number, it changes depending on who you are, how much you earn, what shop you're in. If you shop in Waitrose, your personal inflation rate is going to be a lot lower than if you shop in Lidl because their prices have changed by different amounts. That doesn't mean that Lidl is taking a lot more from its shoppers. It means that it probably sells a lot more basic foods, which are going up in price more steeply. But yeah, it is a contentious subject. But when you look through a lot of companies' earnings statements over the last few months, you can see a lot of them, and a lot of them food companies, they are doing very well at a time when the consumer is not doing very well.
Right. Okay, because the rule, I think there's a part in your piece where you say, actually, if costs are going up, profit margins should really come down. That's what the graph should look like. They shouldn't be staying steady or going up.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That is what one of the economists that I interviewed. And I should say, like I said, it is a bit of a contentious subject, but that's why I chose to interview economists who are, these aren't lefty academics.
Yeah, I think one of them is the chief economist at UBS Global Wealth Management.
Yeah, so, yeah. I deliberately went to people who work for
the New Statesman.
Yeah, commercial banks who are, they're not looking at this phenomenon out of a particular, they're human beings. I'm sure they care if other people can afford food or not, but they also, the aim of their job is to give their investors a good idea of what's happening in the economy. So if they're saying it, then there is very good reason to believe that it is there. And one of them highlighted this particular graph where, using US data, because it's easier to get better data from US companies, but that, yeah, throughout the decades, when costs rise, profits fall, costs cut into profits. But yeah, since the last quarter of last year, those two lines moved apart in a way that he said he had never seen before.
And the reason people or companies can do this is because there's a psychological expectation that companies, that inflation exists and therefore companies can increase their prices. Is that right?
Yeah, they've read all of these stories about the big boat blocking the Suez Canal, supply chains being jangled, you know, the cost of energy, the cost of fertilizer, basically all the things I've written for the last 2 years. And all of those things have been true, that all of those things have been happening. But when you are a company, quite understandably, you might be running a small shop. It's not just supermarkets, although supermarkets are the kind of price leaders. So the prices they set will influence what other people can charge for things. But if you're a shop in a worrying looking economy, you might very well think, I need to add a bit extra to pay for the uncertainty ahead and things like that. So, yeah, it's not necessarily an evil phenomenon, but it is one that where prices creep in.
And why is the market not working here? Because you would expect if one company increases its prices, another company will see an opportunity and reduce its prices and therefore go for market share.
Yeah.
Why is that not happening?
That is, there's a phrase that's more often used in sort of commodity markets than supermarkets, but it says the cure for high prices is high prices. Mm. And that will eventually be true in that the consumer does eventually rebel against high prices and seek lower prices or just stop buying certain things. But firstly, you've got the fact that with a lot of this inflation being in food, that's not something people can decide to stop buying, as with energy. Also, you have a kind of what was talked about during the pandemic more as the K-shaped recovery, where half of society has done quite well. They saved a lot of money during the pandemic. If they owned assets, the prices of those assets were inflated by all the QE that was done. And then you have a lot of other people who haven't had those benefits. But those more affluent consumers, like they're doing all right. They've still got quite a lot of money left. That might be changing now with the savings rates declining, but that buffer has been part of the opportunity for businesses to put up prices because there are still lots of people who can pay them.
Right. Okay. And what we keep being told in terms of the strikes and sort of public sector pay is that it could lead to a wage price spiral and make inflation worse if we give out the pay rises that workers are demanding. But it doesn't seem that there's very much, there's not an equivalent happening for people's wages as there are for companies' profits, for example, as far as I can tell from reading your piece.
No, it is quite surprising how reticent politicians and the Bank of England have been to discuss the idea that company profits might be contributing towards the very stubborn inflation that we have now. And I mean, we had Andrew Bailey talking on the news saying people should show restraint in asking for pay rises. We had Hugh Pill appeared on a podcast more recently and the chief economist at the bank saying, what did he say? He said, we've all got to accept that we're poor. And I think in a way, he nearly got it right in that had he phrased it as everybody in the economy needs to accept that the economy is more broadly poorer because as a country, we have a terms of trade shock and that has to be absorbed by everyone, then I think that's what he meant to say, to be fair to him. But he could have been more specific about talking about companies, Whereas, yeah, it, as it came out, it just sounded like you've all got to accept that you've got less money, so just stop buying as much food, which was obviously extremely unpopular, and you had to apologise for that.
The way that the Bank of England is trying to deal with inflation is by putting up interest rates. I think it's done that 12 times in a row now. But this isn't necessarily being reflected in what banks are offering to consumers, is it?
No. So after the inflation data came out last week, which was not a good number, especially in terms of core inflation, which had risen, interest rate expectations rose, and Nationwide and some other mortgage providers increased the rates they're charging on mortgages. So that even before the Bank of England had put up interest rates, long before they're going to do that, the cost of borrowing to buy a house has risen. But you won't see the same happening. There will not be, I'm confident in saying, a high street bank that will say, do you know what, we're going to add a bit more to your savings account interest because we think interest rates are going to be higher. And in fact, they might wait a few months after the bank raises rates just to be sure. They might never raise them. And it's still possible to get an absolutely terrible savings rate from your bank if you have savings. But yeah, so what banks charge their borrowers rises very quickly, and what they pay their depositors rises very slowly. And that turns up in the net interest income that they make, which is the big component in a high street bank's income, is how much they make from that difference. And yeah, again, they're rebuilding their margins doing that. So before the financial crisis, they could do that. Then 2008 happened and interest rates, the bank rate was taken down almost to zero. And high street banks, much as they, I'm sure they would have loved to, they couldn't pay less than nothing to their depositors for effectively borrowing money from them, which is what your bank does when you put money in your account. Yeah, so they lost a lot of profit over the course of more than a decade because interest rates were so low. Yeah. So now they're seeking to make that money back, get things back to normal. But yeah, in the process, they're going against what the Bank of England wants people to do, because it wants people with savings to keep them in a savings account now. It doesn't want people to go out and spend all their money, because that's more demand in the economy, that's more inflation.
And what about the politics of this? I mean, there's always been a tussle between the government, between the Bank of England, between also consumers about who's responsible for inflation. Liz Truss basically said, it's not my responsibility, it's the Bank of England's responsibility, and they've not done a good job in managing inflation, whereas Rishi Sunak and Jeremy Hunt have made it central to their pledge and promises to the people, the people's priorities, as they call them. They said they're going to halve inflation. And now we've finally got a realisation or a factor of businesses being responsible for managing inflation. Where does responsibility lie now? I think it was interesting what you were saying at the start about there being so many different aspects to inflation, and we can't just simply give responsibility to a single actor in society.
Yeah, I think that was... It always seemed to me a bit odd that Rishi Sunak said, I'm going to halve inflation. I could understand why he said that politically, because he assumed that inflation was going to halve. And he possibly also thought that people might not understand what that meant. He might have thought that people would understand that to mean that the price increases that have happened would have halved, which is not true. It's the speed at which further price increases will happen. Will be halved. But yeah, it was an odd promise to make, and it's turned out to be quite a gamble, because it wasn't really up to him, it was up to the Bank of England. And as transpired last week, inflation is not coming down. I think in terms of core inflation, which is the sort of real temperature of the economy once you take away the volatile prices like energy and food, that I think there were only two countries that have higher rises in core inflation than us. I think that's Argentina, which has got hyperinflation, and South Sudan. So we're quite a serious outlier in that respect. And yeah, so now he's got himself into a position where there is real political urgency to do something about it, in a situation where he was hoping to get away with doing nothing and take the credit. Yeah, it's a tricky one for him. And that's why he is talking to supermarkets about a deal to cap prices, a voluntary cap on prices, some basic foods in supermarkets, which has been tried in France. But we've already seen that's quite divisive within the Tory party, who are not keen on the idea of price caps, not keen on the idea of being seen as, Ted Heath government.
Yeah, you make the point in the piece that John McDonnell told the New Statesman that there should be price controls to control greedflation, and actually optional price caps aren't price controls, but I suppose the language sounds similar to some in the Conservative Party who would be worried about that kind of intervention.
Yeah, they're scared of a return to the 70s, as you say. They just see it as a red line they don't want to cross.
Yeah. But it's a simplistic intervention that's not necessarily going to work because, like I said, this is really complex and you need somebody like a regulator to step in and look at all of the price increases and say what was justified and what wasn't.
That was Ed Davies' suggestion to you in the piece, wasn't it, to have an investigation by the Competition and Markets Authority into supermarkets to see, and he said that prices would probably come down the moment that starts happening.
And you spoke about the responsibility of the Bank of England as well, but one of the key things I took from your piece was, and the solutions that you suggested, was that it's not all up to the Bank of England. If it is necessary for a regulator to come in, then it's in many ways out of the Bank of England's hands, especially if the banks, the retail banks, aren't acknowledging or going in the direction that the Bank of England wants them to go in.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's, the idea that we could just rely on monetary policy to fix things is something that has become politically embedded over the last 10, 15 years. But as we saw when inflation started to come in across the world, it was particularly bad in the UK. And I think that was possibly as a result of a number of political decisions that don't have much to do with monetary policy, things like the health of our workforce and things like that, or the freedom of movement, that kind of thing, which meant that put more pressure on the labour market. Yeah, the behaviour of businesses within your economy is obviously going to affect inflation and the way in which you regulate them. And it's not a good idea to just say there's one lever for that.
No.
And obviously the consequences of greedflation, it puts the cost of inflation on the backs of the people who can least afford it. But also there's more dramatic consequences that some of your sources talk about in the piece. Albert Edwards, who's the head of global strategy at a French multinational bank, he talks about the French Revolution and Tiananmen Square.
Yeah, it's always nice when an interviewee bring up the idea.
We'll give you a nice closing paragraph for your piece.
Yeah. But food prices are linked in a bunch of academic literature to political upheaval. There were, when Russia invaded Ukraine last year, there were a number of people predicting that there would be bread riots, as there were, again, also before the Arab Spring.
Sudan as well.
Yeah, and like there would be upsets around the world as a result of a sharp spike in food prices. And that was, there was a good bit of international cooperation that went on that meant that didn't happen as severely as it could have done. But yeah, I think it's exposed weaknesses in our economy that we were, or perhaps our government was a bit complacent.
Thanks so much, Will. And you can read more about this in Will's excellent cover piece in this week's New Statesman, The Rise of Greedflation. And it will also be an audio long read on our audio long read podcast, which you can subscribe to and listen to on Saturday. After the break, we'll answer your question about Labour's housing plans. If you're subscribed to The New Statesman, you can get all our episodes ad-free on the New Statesman app. You can get it on both iOS and Android. Just search for New Statesman on the App Store or Google Play Store. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
If you enjoy the New Statesman podcast, then you'll love our daily politics newsletter, Morning Call. It's a quick, essential guide to the big political story each morning by me, Freddie Hayward and Rachel Wearmouth, featuring original reporting from Westminster and beyond, our analysis of the latest political news, and some recommendations of the best reads of the day. Sign up for free at the link in the podcast description.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Now it's time for a section we like to call...
You Ask Us.
You Ask... Oh, I'm never gonna...
From You Ask Will to You Ask Us. The question today is whether Keir Starmer can really make housing more affordable. So Labour's had a bit of a flurry of housing announcements and re-announcements lately, building on the Green Belt, ending leasehold and allowing local authorities to buy land at a price that doesn't reflect the value that, you know, planning permissions on that land could give it. First of all, what do you make of the fact that they're majoring on housing at the moment, Freddie? Do they see it as a sort of wedge issue between their party and the sort of NIMBYs on the Tory benches that the government can never quite cross?
Yeah, because they weren't doing that 6 months ago. It wasn't a big part of their... It wasn't one of their five key missions for government. They've slotted it underneath the economic growth one. But if you look at the briefing...
Yeah,
it's a tiny little section. And then what we've seen in the past month or 2 months or so is a huge number of announcements. Whether those announcements actually result in a serious reforming agenda for housing, I think, is less clear. If you actually go down to some of the details of the policies, they're not as radical as they seem, and they're actually not too far away from where the government are on certain things. So that's something to look at. But I think we are going to see a ramping up of their rhetoric on this. We've got Lisa Nandy delivering a big speech just before conference, which we spoke about in Morning Call, or revealed in Morning Call a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. And I think Keir Starmer has been quite... I think bombastic is probably too strong a word, but he has been quite hardline on housing, and he has tried to strike a few divides with the government. I think it was interesting, we saw a report from Onward this week talking about millennials, missing millennials, and how the Conservative Party is really struggling to attract young people. And once you drill down into the polling of what were the top issues that millennials, which they define as between 25 and 40, I think, what they really care about. Housing is up there. It's not for the general population, but it is for the millennials. So I think Labour are seeing an opportunity here. But more broadly, and going back to the missions, they see it as a way of driving economic growth. Or maybe they see a housing policy as needing to be justified by driving economic growth. So that's where they are at the moment. And we are seeing a ratcheting up of rhetoric. But I think the policies themselves do need a little bit more scrutiny.
Yeah, and even Labour, it's difficult to find consensus for these kind of policies. I remember when the Green Belt announcement came out, I was on a politics programme, yeah, and there was a Labour MP on, Sarah Champion. She hadn't heard about these plans and she thought that it wasn't Labour policy. And when she was asked about it, she was pretty... She doesn't really want to commit to it, because obviously any politician in their seat are going to have areas where people will oppose building on that land. John McDonnell as well came out to say that he wanted the Green Belt protected in London.
Sadiq Khan as well.
Yeah.
It's remarkable when you actually look at what the Green Belt is and how the debate has changed around it. Councils can already change the Green Belt. They're discouraged to do so, but they can change where the Green Belt goes if they want to put housing on that area. So that there's many things that mean that Labour aren't just suddenly going to build loads and loads of houses on the Green Belt. We've already seen, for instance, the government have also said that they are going to look at allowing councils in exceptional circumstances to build on the Green Belt. How radical it is, and whether all these things come together to see them meet this huge housing target that they need to meet to fill the backlog that we've developed in the past decade or so, it's unclear. It's very unclear.
Yeah, and I suppose it would mean forcing people like Sadiq Khan and others in local authorities and mayoralties to not oppose planning on the Green Belt in areas where councils want to build.
Yeah, exactly. So much of it is about planning, which we've not really seen Labour talk much about recently.
Yeah.
And getting over that local opposition, convincing people, convincing councils, convincing councillors, that's really important as well. We've not seen much debate about that.
Yeah. And what about this legislation to allow councils to buy land for a lot cheaper than they already can, Will? Is that the kind of thing that could make a big difference? Is it a radical policy?
Yeah, I think going back to the beginning of the sort of current phase of the climbing house prices at the sort of what many people see as an inflection point was the right to buy policy, which took a lot of council housing out of social housing and into private hands. That's the sort of side of it that's always told. But the other side of it was the Treasury borrowing limits that were imposed on councils and the way in which councils, from that point onwards, stopped building social housing. Yeah, I think it is widely accepted that is the remedy for the lack of social housing, is for councils to be able to build it.
Yeah.
But obviously, council finances are not in a good way because they haven't been allowed to build social housing, which is really, you know, good source of income for a council as well. Yeah. They've been building things like shopping centres, and commercial real estate is in real trouble. I should say, to be fair to Sunak and Hunt, they are certainly doing their bit to make pre-existing housing cheaper by failing to combat inflation. After the inflation data came out last week, obviously those interest rate expectations go up, mortgage prices go up, and so you've got fewer first-time buyers can get into the market, and large numbers of people are facing significantly repriced mortgages when they refinance, which about 1.5 million people are doing this year. Just out this morning was the news that the housing market has had its biggest annual fall since 2009 so far this year. And yeah, they're certainly making houses a bit cheaper, but not more affordable. So they're becoming cheaper and less affordable, which, yeah, personally, I think it, when you look at the number of mortgages that will be refinanced over the coming year and up till the next general election, what might happen to rents with people, landlords getting out of the market as a result of that, what will happen to all the people who own houses that might they might have seen as investments, which will also be going down in price. It does seem like a really politically astute thing to be concentrating on.
Yeah. It does, especially because so many Conservative voters already own their home. They don't necessarily have a mortgage, so those problems and those higher prices don't really affect them.
Yeah. And also, as people come to remortgage, they may be reminded of one of the reasons why the interest rates have gone up so much. Often people associate that with Liz Truss's premiership, and that's something that will be an ongoing problem, I think, for the Conservatives. As long as Labour keeps saying Tory mortgage crisis, I think it will be politically beneficial to them. And just lastly, on the leasehold issue, so this was one of Michael Gove's aims, was to try and abolish leasehold. He didn't quite manage to persuade Number 10 or the Treasury that's the way to go. And Will, you've written a very good piece about why actually it would be pretty difficult to do, at least in terms of existing leaseholders. Maybe trying to change the system in the future might be something that is a little easier. That's something that Labour's saying, and then they're saying, and a workable way to change current leaseholders into common hold, but they haven't really laid out their plans for exactly how that would work. But that's also an interesting point of difference, I think, now between the opposition and the government. I've been reporting on a lot on the cladding crisis, but also on leasehold in general. The cladding crisis is probably the sort of however you say it, it's the ultimate symbol of the injustice of the leasehold system. And every time I reported on this, people would say, yeah, it's awful, but it's not. It's just Labour voters. It's just in cities. It's just in areas where there's new build houses. And actually, that's not true. So a lot of the people that I've been interviewing for a piece that I'm about to publish are in red wall seats. So you have this system happening in houses that have been bought up in old mining towns, old miners' houses bought up by big faceless companies, and people's service charges suddenly rocketing. You have new build housing estates, which are now being called fleecehold, because while they are freehold, the council isn't the one doing the maintenance of the communal gardens and areas. You actually have to pay an extra charge on those places that you have no control over. So I do think that it is probably a more electorally significant issue than perhaps some in the Conservative Party realise.
I think it will be. And it's, just going back to our previous conversation about inflation, as this anger builds up about the economy, it'll express itself in probably quite indirect and general ways. People don't necessarily think about all the different parts to inflation and where they should necessarily blame, whether it should be the Bank of England or the government or companies. But if there is a general malaise with the economy, we do know that usually, and house prices fit into that as well, we do know that usually that goes very badly for the government.
Yeah, and the leaseholds, I think that is contested how many leaseholds there actually are across the UK, but it is millions of households. Yeah. And it does have a strong whiff of, people have called, I think Michael Gove called it, a feudal system. It does have a strong whiff of aspirational working people who want to buy their own home being fleeced by landowners. It does have quite a smell of the 18th century or earlier.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Will. It was great to have you. And thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to submit a question for us to discuss on a future podcast, you can do so at newstatesman.com/youaskus. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shekelian, and my colleagues Freddie Haywood and Will Dunn. We'll be back on Monday to discuss how to fix the Met. Follow us on your podcast app to make sure you get new episodes as soon as they're released. You can also watch video from this podcast on our YouTube channel. Just search YouTube for the New Statesman.
We're produced by Adrian Bradley.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.